once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and...
Jeff McClure.
And I totally didn't say our last name. I didn't say it.
Well...
We're out of practice.
You're out of practice. We've been out of the loop for a couple of weeks, and as a result, you forgot how to say your last name.
Sometimes that happens.
Yeah.
I'm also McClure, as far as the last name goes, just to, if anybody's missed that. We've been out of town. He's been on the East Coast. I've been in the Rockies. We've just been exploring the United States economy. We try to time it for summer. Because Texas. Yeah. Yes.
I got you.
That should be enough. If you don't get that, it's really hard to give context to talk about the blazing heat of Texas to someone that doesn't know what it is. So, yes, it is.
On the way back yesterday, as we were driving between Waco and Temple, the thermometer reading on my vehicle said 111 degrees. Consistently.
It's just broken, and all it could write was ones.
And it also said that up in the Dallas area, and I really believed it in Dallas.
Well, coming back from Colorado, a day ago, it was in the low 70s for the high, and coming into Texas and watching it climb up to 109, 110 as we're driving along was horrible. And then we had this rainstorm come over us and hit us. And I haven't watched a thermometer drop that quickly. I don't think ever. We dropped about 35 degrees in about 2 minutes, just watching it drop. So it was fantastic. And so this is how we come back from our rest. We just begin by talking about the weather because...
Wait a minute. You said you had a what storm?
Yeah, I know. That was weird. It was in Texas. We had a rainstorm in Texas.
A what?
It just
what is that word again?
Rain. It's where
rain?
Somebody,
is that like when a king is in charge of everything?
No, it's like when they leave the sprinklers on, only the sprinklers shoot from a long ways away. It's weird. Water comes out of the sky.
Wow.
Yeah.
That really happens?
Yes. Not in Texas, evidently, or not at least in our part of Texas. But yes. So we have experienced weather other than heat. We should be ready to talk about economics other than interest rates. We're still going to talk about that. Sorry. No, can't go away from that. So let's give the disclosures before we go any farther. First disclosure is we talk about the weather sometimes. I know, but we're not meteorologists, not even close. We just talk, sure is hot out there, isn't it? So we do like to state the obvious because we're economists. That's what we do. We just state the obvious very vaguely. So that's the second disclosure. We will vaguely state the obvious and then act like we're very proud of ourselves when people recognize and say, hey, look, it's obvious. And we say, yes, we saw it too. This is The Personal Wealth Coach, which not coincidentally is not just the name of the program and the podcast, but also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm. Now, that's not coincidental. The program, the radio program, predates the firm as far as investment advice and so on. It's been around a long time. These two bald guys with beards talking a long, long time. But just because the firm is registered with the SEC doesn't mean that they approve, give any kind of a attaboy, gal, any kind of pronoun you want to throw in there to anyone, because they don't do that. I realize that's very rude. They don't even acknowledge and give a thumbs up to anyone, but that's their job. They're a regulator. So they require everyone who mentions that they're registered with the SEC to state clearly that the SEC is not endorsing them. And I think that's rather ludicrous. Anybody thinks that the SEC endorses anything is out of their minds. But okay, so we've said that. Secondarily, just because it's an investment advisory firm doesn't mean we can do that on the air. Well, why not? Why not give good investment advice on the air? This is what people want, right? They want to give good investment. Well, investment advice is different for different people. There's rules for privacy. There's rules for understanding whether or not it's a good idea for a specific person to do a specific thing. Those rules are pretty important. So we can't do that on the air, except to say buy low, sell high. There you go. Don't get involved in a land war in Asia. Oh, wait, that's not investment stuff. Maybe it is. I don't know. It's military investment. We can't give investment advice. This program is educational in nature. Hopefully, we're teaching you something besides just being more confusing. Maybe. We're striving. I pulled something the other day, striving so hard to, yes. We're not paying for this radio program. I know, it's weird. It's a Saturday morning. You turn on AM radio, you change station to station, and you're going to hear paid commercial advertisement. We've been, for some still unknown reason, we've been doing this for 25, 26 years?
Mm-hmm. 26 years.
26 years, gainfully unemployed, talking to masses of people. Why? Well, we think it's important that people get educated on this. I wish I had heard a radio program like ours, but I probably, if I had, I probably would have changed the channel. We're endorsing that if you wish. Okay, so you have the last disclosure, maybe the most important disclosure, but you can tell because it's in monotone, high speed, and legalese. So get ready. Here it comes.
The information presented on this educational radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said statements.
However, we do guarantee and warranty that any information we do not give has been ungiven by us. Guaranteed.
Yep.
Right. So now, what happened this week and other weeks, actually, in the market? You can give us a lot of perspective here, please.
Well, it's August, and traditionally, the S&P 500 likes to slide downhill in August and to some degree in September before it gets over it about mid-October. And so that is not always true, although I've heard people make speeches and saying that's the sure way to get rich is sell in May and go away and wait till October before you buy again. It doesn't always work that way.
Doesn't always work. Yeah, sometimes it works really, really, really not like the opposite of working.
Yeah, you basically, if you'd done that for a long period of time, you would have lost some significant money. Anyway, the S&P 500 stock index, which is the one we use as an indicator of the market rather than the Dow Jones Industrial Average, because Dow Jones Industrial Average, frankly, is only 30 stocks and probably they generally run pretty close to each other, but sometimes one goes up and the other one goes down. So the 500 stock index is the one we use. It did an up and down dance all week. Where traders are trying to figure out what's good news, what's bad news, and what good news is bad news, and what bad news is good news. And they're very confused. And if you feel like you're confused about what causes the market to go up and down, I don't think you're any more confused than they are. They're often confused, but they never show it. They make clear statements as to why they did what they did when they really don't know, which is a suitably American pastime. Anyway, for the last 3 weeks, not counting this week, the 3 weeks prior, it was dropping, and it dropped a couple of percent, actually dropped about 4-point-something percent. But this week, it changed its mind, and it rose 0.82% after going up and down vigorously all during the week. Now, that's not a big change. However, if you multiply it times 52, it becomes huge, which for 52 weeks. So it was a pretty good rise in the S&P 500.
It's a bad idea to multiply things right by 52 in general. Just going around multiplying things by 52 can get you very confused.
Well,
speed limits particularly.
Particularly the quarters. The Labor Department, the Commerce Department, and just about everybody else comes out with these numbers.
Annualized.
Like when they report the GDP for one quarter, they multiply it times 4 to give you the annualized number and don't tell you what it really did in the quarter. You have to figure it out for yourself. I don't understand that.
Doesn't make a lot of sense.
There's other reports from the same departments, whether it be the Labor Department or the Commerce Department. There's some other reports they have where when they give you the number, it's not for the whole year. It's just for that time period. And they don't, in many cases, now it's in the actual report, but in many cases, the news media does not mention what the time period is it's referring to. So when you ask somebody, what's the GDP look like for this quarter? Right now, it's the estimate from the Richmond Fed, Federal Reserve Bank, and from Moody's is it's going to be like above 4%, like 4.8% is the last one I heard. But that's not for the quarter, even though they say it's for the quarter. That's if it rose at, if it rose at the same rate for the whole year as it's going to rise this quarter.
Wait a minute. Are you saying that there might be wobbly data there when you estimate something and then you multiply it by a large number? You might have a little error in there somewhere?
Yeah.
Maybe?
Anyway.
So we're not multiplying by 52 when it comes to the weekly returns. But if we did, it would be astronomically large.
There's this big argument going on in the market, in effect, and that's why it zigzags up and down, as to whether we're headed into a recession because the Federal Reserve is going to raise interest rates too much, or whether this really healthy-looking economy that we're in is just going to earn more, create more earnings and make stocks relatively cheap now, even though some people think they're expensive. So there's big arguments going on, and that's normal in a bull market and is going. But it was interesting that it actually got its gain on Friday. It was pretty well neutral going into Friday. And it got its gain as Jerome Powell, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, was making a speech at Jackson Hole, the annual symposium the Federal Reserve holds there, stating that inflation is still too high and there's a distinct possibility they'll have to raise interest rates some more, which normally would cause the market to go down, but in this case, it caused the market to go up. I really understand that, but I'm not going to go into it. Okay, so this 0.82% rise, where does that leave us? The index is up 14.75% this year, 23% higher than last October 12th, 97% higher than in March 2020, and about 25% higher than it was 3 years ago. Of course, it's important to note that if you invested a lot of money in an S&P 500 index in about January 6th of 2022, you'd be down 8% or something like that. So the market is not at anything like an all-time high, despite the fact it's risen quite a lot since October.
So it's not an all-time high, but it's way up over what it was several years ago. It doesn't feel so good if you got in at the beginning of 2022.
Mm-hmm. But if you're a long-term investor, 3 years is the minimum time that you should be looking at. And it's actually averaged greater than a 10% average annual rate of return or something like that over that period. Anyway, the yield on the 10-year U.S. Treasury note, which is the fascinating thing to me, last week it jumped rather substantially. It slipped a little bit this week, 0.01%, which really doesn't count to much. So it's yielding 4.25%. Now, that's really unusually high for the 10-year note in the last decade or so. Now, you go back into the 1990s, and that was a pretty normal level. And that looks more and more what we're returning to. The short-term Treasury securities, they're called bills. They mature in 1 year or less. They climb to well over 5.5%. They were up a little bit. It's the 6 month T bill, for example, if you annualize it, is 5.61%. Again, that's annualized. Yields on the 20 and 30 year bonds climbed a bit. They're at 4.5 and 4.3. So we have this kind of interesting shape to the yield curve right now. It's inverted, yes, meaning short-term rates are much higher than long-term rates. But short-term rates are high and they're still rising. Long-term rates are rising also, and in the middle, the 10-year note is pretty much the lowest point in the yield curve, which is sort of odd. So we have sort of this V-shaped yield curve, which
I think it looks more like a seagull.
The seagull.
Yeah. So like in all the pictures of the coast, you see the little seagulls. They're not,
yeah, the
like
M-shaped sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it's flattened. It's really, McDonald's. It's sort of interesting. Right. Maybe it's advertising. Maybe that's it.
We don't have a name for that in economics, by the way. It's still technically inverted because the low end is definitely higher than the mid and the long end, but it's got some weirdness to it. It's fun to watch.
It is. So generally speaking, if you're a long-term investor, the market is up. The stock market, yes?
We have an opportunity to name this yield curve, but we don't know what to name it.
We could yield it. We could call it the Mike curve, the McDonald curve.
The McDonald curve, or we could call it the McClure curve. There we go.
Okay, we'll call it the McClure curve. I don't want to.
We could name something horrible that we never want to see again after us. Wouldn't that be great? That's kind of the way people feel about us, right? Well, wait, maybe not quite so bad. All right.
So, last comment about stocks.
Okay.
I haven't said anything about what happened with Earl. I usually say something about what, Earl.
West Texas Intermediate Earl?
Yeah, it didn't do much. It rose just a little bit for the week. It's about $82 a barrel, which is why you see diesel and gasoline prices up a little bit. Didn't do much this week, just like the interest rates didn't do much.
Yeah. Just driving across New Mexico and Colorado, seeing the gas prices was fascinating.
Oh yeah, same was true in the Appalachians. Tremendous variance.
One town to the next could be 50 cents different at the pump. Pretty amazing.
Yeah. It pretty much matches with what's going on in the economy and the markets. Nobody really has. There's very few people out there who remember this economic situation. And as a result, people don't know which way to jump.
Right. And we'll talk more about that specifically, because it's absolutely amazing stuff. It's great to look at. Our economy is essentially out of sync. But let's wrap up the marketplace.
Well, last thing I have to say is interest rates, the question keeps being raised by the pundits, when are interest rates going to come down? And the answer from what I can see is not anytime soon. And there's a couple of reasons for that, which I'd like to touch on.
Yeah.
The issue
is that the end of the market, though.
That's what happened in the markets.
That's what happened in the markets. Okay. All right. So
why is there a separate issue?
So now you're going to jump into why, and I have great stuff to add to this, why it is that the interest rates are not likely to come down anytime soon.
Right.
Go ahead.
It gets a little complicated, except for the fact that, Jake, you probably know the exact number, how big the Fed's balance sheet is at this point, but it's big. Now, what do you mean by balance sheet? That means they are in possession of a lot of bonds that they bought out of the market. Now, when the Fed buys bonds on the open market, by the way, the committee that we talk about when the committee meets and they set the interest rate, it's called the Federal Open Market Committee.
So I'm going to round this to the nearest million. $8,139,066,000,000. That's the balance sheet at the moment.
Yes. That by the way is a lot.
Yes. That when you're doing that in math, we just replace, and a lot of times like in formulas, you replace numbers with variables. So we just replace it with the word lot.
Yeah.
It just makes more sense. Bunch, lot,
bunch
stuff
or
like that.
Lot. Yeah. It a makes whole, it really, a whole lot is a
real big. Real big.
Right.
Okay.
Because during the pandemic, the Fed vigorously bought bonds. Now, they bought mortgage bonds, they bought treasury bonds, and in doing so, as they're busily buying, that's called demand.
Right. They had $3.7 trillion on their balance sheet prior to the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
So they bought almost $5 trillion, so far more than doubled.
So what you've got is the Fed holds a lot of bonds, and it doesn't like holding a lot of bonds. It likes having a lower level of balance sheet so it can go back in and buy bonds again in the future if it needs to. So when the Fed bought all those bonds, what that did is effectively converted paper. It's not technically paper, but it converted a bond, which you can't use to buy groceries with or cars or anything. It's a very nice instrument. It's a financial instrument, but it isn't money. It converts bonds to money, which puts more money into the system.
So what it does, it's buying. Here's some dollars. Go spend them. I'm going to take that bond. Okay.
Yeah. Now, they need to get rid of a lot of bonds. They want to get rid of a lot of bonds. And they do that by selling the bonds back into the market. Now, when they buy bonds in the market, that means there is a high demand for the bond. Interest rates go down and the value of the underlying bonds that are on the market go up, which makes everybody relatively happy. Now, when they start selling bonds into the market, they are supplied. The market has limited demand. So what happens then is the price of bonds go down. And as the price of bonds go down, what we notice is the interest rate on a given bond goes up, because they're paying the same fixed payment to you every month or every quarter. And as the principal value of that bond on the open market goes down, your interest rate effectively goes up, even though you're only receiving the same number of dollars. So that's what raises interest rates. Well, the Fed has got a lot of selling into the market left to do.
Which means interest rates aren't going to be coming down when they do that. They're selling $95 billion with a B, $95 billion of bonds a month.
Yep. And if you want to know when interest rates are possibly going to come down. There's no guarantee that will happen either. Just watch the Fed's balance sheet. When it gets back to the point that they were pre-pandemic, then there is the possibility that interest rates will come down at some point. Just the possibility, not a certainty. But until it's back to the balance it was in 2019, don't expect to see interest rates come down. And I don't really understand why the pundits and the traders and the people who are doing things with bonds are waiting for the interest rates to suddenly drop, because the Fed has got a lot of selling to do. And as long as they've got a lot of selling to do, interest rates are going to be high, all other things aside. And when you combine the fact that they have a lot of selling to do and the economy is still, by their terms, running too hot, no, we're not going to see interest rates come down anytime soon. So if you're waiting on that one, you're going to wait a long time.
At the current extremely rapid rate of sale from the Fed at about $95 billion a month, it'll take us between 52 and 53 months to get back to where we were pre-pandemic. That's more than 4 years.
Well, at that point, the
Fed, and that's with no hiccups in the middle. Because we had, if you go back to SVB and the failure there, the Federal Reserve pumped $500 billion back into their balance sheet because they gave out loans with bonds as collateral to all those middle-sized banks. $500 billion. This is why right after the failure of the bank, we said we don't see a lot of problem in the future. The Fed just came in and rescued everybody. It's kind of like in banking, you don't want to be at the front of the herd to fall, to be the first ones to fall off the cliff, because you're going to die. Everybody else, there's a big safety net that comes sweeping out from both ends and catches you. But if you're at the first part of the pack, yeah. So $500 billion got added back to the sheet. That's like more than 5 months that got added back into how long interest rates have to be up. So if we have any more hiccups like that, it means even longer into the future will those interest rates be high.
So what we've got is a situation where, and we've been talking about this for so long, but I just noticed in the journal and other publications, they're finally beginning to acknowledge the reality of it. Eventually, we'll get back to a positive yield curve, with short-term interest rates being lower than long-term interest rates, because that is the native state of any yield curve of bonds. However, getting back to that yield curve probably will not involve the short-term rates going back down to next to zero. It will involve short-term rates returning to their long-term average, which is not quite as high as it is now, around 3%, in other words, and the longer-term rates going higher. And we're really starting to see that happen now. So again, if you own a portfolio of bonds or a bond mutual fund and you look at your return over the last several years, it is either going to be an extremely low number or negative. And that is not likely to change in the near future. There's a lot of people who'd like it to change and believe it will change because they've only experienced low interest rates and they think that's normal. But it is abnormal, and there's nothing likely to generate them again.
Yeah. We have a question from Inquisitor John, and it's sort of on topic.
Yeah, it's pretty much what we've just been talking about.
Yeah, so Inquisitor John, our most faithful questioner, he questions us about everything, including our fashion. We're not as apt in that area as we are in the economic field. I know, isn't that a surprise to everyone? Okay, John says, a big bank bankruptcy plans, which has a bit of alliteration to it, just to begin with. The concept here is that big banks, according to the Dodd-Frank Act that happened after the global financial crisis, the two guys that helped lead us into it also helped lead us out of it, or at least want to take credit for the second one and not the first, created this law that basically said, if you're a big bank, we need to know that if you fail, we can sell your assets to other banks without having to spend a bunch of taxpayer money to do it, which, if you ask me, sounds like a pretty good idea. So the big question is, why didn't the medium-sized banks have to go through that? And his question at the beginning is, what would a plan for a mega bank like JP Morgan look like? So this concept, and in banking, it's kind of called a living will, which is a dumb name for it because that's not what living wills are. A will is a will. It's not a living will. It's a will. Anyway, that's just me being pedantic again. though, why feet have anything to do with pedanticness. Anyway, let's just jump. That was way pedantic, double pedantic. What would a big bank like J.P. Morgan look like if it were going under? Well, first off, J.P. Morgan is really two banks. This is weird because Glass-Steagall said it's two banks. This is an act that was done in 1933. So come forward, we removed a big chunk of that prior to the global financial crisis. And an investment bank, which are banks that help companies issue bonds and issue stocks, and a commercial bank, which are banks that give mortgages and take your deposits and you do debit cards and checking and all that stuff with. Okay. In the 1930s, we said, nope, we can't have that. You guys are got to be separated. All the commercial banks were investing in the stock market and they took their deposits. So magnify what happened with SVB and First Republic by a lot. They took their owners' deposits, their customers' deposits, and invested in really risky stocks. So we had this horrible collapse that took place, 1929, Great Depression. So Glass-Steagall came out and said, hey, we can't have banks that are commercial banks being the same banks that are investment banks. You guys need to get out of each other's way. Get away. So come forward, and we repealed a big chunk of that law in 2006. And we said, okay, you guys can own each other again. So one of the largest commercial banks and one of the largest investment banks started courting each other. There were flowers, there were chocolates, there was romantic music, and dun, 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 dun. J.P. Morgan and Chase came together, and there was a lot of confusion at the beginning as to which bank's name would be kept by the other nuptial partner. And it's been sort of kind of coming out over this as recently as now to just be J.P. Morgan. Even though Chase still exists, J.P. Morgan is what people talk. Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan, the Chase part's seeming to fall off. So anyway, J.P. Morgan would have to look at selling the investment part of its banking and the commercial side of its banking, and it's a lot. They have an entire group of people, large group of people, dedicated to keeping this will, as they call it, a living will, active. When they acquire assets, they also have to figure out who they would sell those assets to, because they have to have a, hey, in the event of my untimely demise, these people should buy this stuff at this price. Otherwise, you get a fire sale auction and the shareholders don't get anything. Shareholders. These banks are owned by people. And in SVB, when it collapsed, we had a two-person auction where the FDIC and the Federal Reserve auctioned off the assets to, like, what's your bid on this? Okay, that's the only bid. There you go. You can have it. When the underlying value of the assets, these are bonds that are worth a lot of money. They're just down in the market today. If you wait till they mature, you get a much larger amount of money. Well, these banks that stepped in and bought those assets made a huge amount of money. Who lost the money? Because the customers got their money back. FDIC protected everybody. This large amount of money was made by the buyer. Who lost the money? Somebody lost money here. If somebody made a bunch of money by buying somebody's stuff, somebody had to sell it. Who did it? Well, it was the shareholders of the bank. They don't like that. So they have these wills that say, hey, we have an agreement with those nine banks out there to buy this asset or this group of assets. And those documents, if they were printed out, which they're not printed out, by the way, as crazy as that sound, we're actually electronic enough that I don't think the living will of J.P. Morgan Chase has ever actually been printed on paper. It might have been, but that would have filled rooms.
When you're dealing with the government, if you've ever looked up a bill that's been passed by Congress, you discover that it is on paper. Now they do a PDF of the paper, but they first put it on paper.
Somebody printed it out and then scanned it. Where's the waste in government? It's not in government. It's what they require us to do elsewhere, mm-hmm. which is part of the answer to the second question. Why don't medium-sized banks like the recent California banks require similar plans? Well, the answer is because they're hard to keep up to date. Imagine if every time you bought something in just on your own portfolio, every time you bought a share of a mutual fund, not just the mutual fund, I own this mutual fund. No, I mean, each share, you have to designate somebody to receive that. I mean, you can do it relatively easily. Just say my kids are going to get it. Well, would your kids buy it from your estate? Probably, maybe, no. I don't know. They would have to sell it for. So this is the deal. This is why it's hard, and it's hard for medium-sized banks to keep up with that. They would basically have to go into some kind of agreement with the large banks. So in a very lovingly titled the EGRR CPA of 2018. We love that name. Isn't it great? We make fun of all the acronyms that Congress makes for their laws, but sometimes they don't make them, and we're like, what are we supposed to call this? Economic Growth Recovery, Regulatory Relief and Consumer Protection Act. That's more than a mouthful. You can't really get that out. But 2018, the same law that changed when stress tests, when the Federal Reserve and the FDIC could kind of breathe loudly through their nose over the shoulder of the banks and say, show us all this stuff. Tell us what would happen in this event. They changed the number for the amount of assets in hand that the bank had to have from $50 billion to $250 billion to get those stress tests. Part of the stress test is that living will that we've been talking about. If you don't have $50 billion in assets, it's really hard to afford the time and the constant set of negotiations with other banks to keep that thing up to date and accurate. You could have just a universal, hey, that bank over there will buy all our stuff. But that bank over there needs to be a really big bank now, because what if they're going through problems at the same time, which is why the Federal Reserve wants a bunch of banks involved in these living wills, and this bank shall receive this, and that bank shall receive that, and so on. So it's hard. It's really also hard to look back at what happened at SVB and First Republic and say, oh, well, that was good for the economy. So this is my essential non-answer to your question, John, about why they're not recovered and why they're not required to do the living will type thing. Regulations on banks are necessary. Overregulation on banks is extremely destructive. So what's the right amount? Don't know. I tell you what, though, the next disaster, I'll say we should have done better there.
Well,
that's how we regulate. That's how the world regulates, because you never know what disaster is gonna happen next, and you try to regulate the ones that have happened a lot. Go ahead.
There's a fundamental driving factor in whether the federal government steps in and when they want to put special restrictions because they might have to step in. And it boils down to, if a bank is, in the words of they come out of Washington, systemically critical. In other words, it's big enough, or for whatever reason,
too big to fail.
Its failure would potentially put the entire United system at risk.
There's a lot of dominoes. If the first dominoes fall and don't hit any others, that's great. But if the domino is big enough, it's going to hit a lot of dominoes. Go ahead.
If a local bank in Killeen, I don't know that there are any local banks in Killeen anymore, but Union State used to be an example. I don't know if they're still there, were to fail, would it be a systemic problem? No, because it's the damage would be there. The shareholders would hurt. The Union State wouldn't pay back some of its creditors if it had creditors, but it would be okay. Now, if on the other hand, you have a multi-state bank and the multi-state bank has got loans, has borrowed money from other banks or other systems, and when it fails, it effectively is saying, we're not paying you back. And that causes those other banks to fail.
And not pay you other banks back.
So what's happening is the FDIC and the Comptroller of the Currency and the Federal Reserve put their heads together and said, well, because of, among other things, Twitter or whatever it's called now. It's not called, is it called X now?
It's called X now, yes.
Because of X and other similar programs.
The social network formerly known as Twitter.
This is...
We are now the knights who say, icky, 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 icky.
Sorry, go ahead.
Icky, 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 X.
Bang, wow. X.
Yes. So if... They're now taking a look at the fact that a mid-sized bank has the capability of causing a major financial disruption in the United States. So what they're looking at is if you're capable of causing a major economic dislocation in the United States, you're going to need to hold bigger reserves to try to hit off bank runs. And one of the things that economists don't like to talk about, bankers don't like to talk about, we don't even like to talk about it, but I think it's important to understand. Banks operate on faith. And just as in a fireside chat in 1934, Franklin Delano Roosevelt explained, and if you see It's a Wonderful Life, you'll recognize this is from there. The money that you put in the bank and they're paying you interest on is not held in a vault. It's loaned out. And they can't usually call those loans, which means that if everybody shows up and wants their money back, the bank has got to shut down. Alternatively, if the bank doesn't shut down, we could do what has happened on a few occasions, and the Federal Reserve show up with just a whole lot of money.
Or we could do what used to happen 1,000 years ago on to hundreds of years ago, and that would just be lynch the bankers and burn down the bank.
There you go.
We've decided that's not an effective way of getting your money back. Yeah.
All right. So the issue is that all banks anywhere operate on a faith system. And that's you have faith in the system that you won't lose your money, which is what FDIC insurance is all about. Once you get above FDIC insurance, believe it or not, folks, your money is at risk. If the bank fails, you may not get anything. You may not get more than $250,000 back. That's the reality, I think, that we have had a tendency to forget about. And that's where the danger comes in. And if a bank is big enough that if it fails, it's liable to communicate, it's contagious to where we'll go to other financial institutions, then the Fed, the FDIC, and the Treasury, and everybody else, the Comptroller of the Currency, are saying you're going to have to hold bigger reserves than small banks. So they're just shuffling it down to the mid-sized thing. By the way, this is ironic. The Dodd-Frank bill would have included the banks that failed in California,
yes,
in Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
However,
it did include it. But the Economic Growth Regulatory Relief and Consumer Protection Act of 2018 said, nah, it's okay. You guys go have fun.
And from a political point of view, that was under President Trump and a Republican-dominated Congress, which, you know, more free market, less the more profit for banks.
We're not necessarily saying it was a bad decision. This is weird. Even though banks failed doing this, we have to look at when is regulation too much? And we have seen a lot of middle-sized banks just disappear in the last decade. We don't want that. And we want middle-sized banks.
It's a hard call. It's a hard thing to say where should the cutoff be where things are systemically important.
Right. When I say disappear, they got purchased by other banks. We've got to play some commercials. Yeah, we have commercials to play. If you would like to join the conversation, we have email addresses waiting. That's their job. They wait. Sometimes they receive, but mostly they wait. If you would like to email us and ask us a question that we will endeavor to talk about on the program, the email addresses are jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com. That's The Personal Wealth Coach or tangopapawhiskeycharlie.com. And we'll be back on the other side of these very important announcements from our sponsors. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jake and
Jeff McClure.
Yes. We are going to continue our commentary on the economy in general, what's happening globally. But I think we've just been traveling, so there's some anecdotal stuff. We usually look at really, really big picture numbers to see prices of, you know, gas and oil across, and you can see averages across states and so on. Driving across the country for us is fascinating stuff. So going from a little town in New Mexico to the next little town in New Mexico and seeing the difference of 50 some odd cents a gallon in gas, sometimes more. And this is one of those things that people go, how can that be? What's going on? There's a combination of things. We've talked about some of this stuff before. Why is it that this is going on? How is that happening? In a larger town, you can see it on a much more muted scale. You can go from one area of town to another and see differences in prices. They're buying the oil from the same places, right? Well, yeah. Yeah, they are. Sometimes it costs more to ship it. I love that we call taking it on a truck, shipping it. To get it from one part of the country to the other, the distance from the source, the refinery, is pretty important. I mean, that's a big factor. A lot of times there's pipelines that lead it up to tanks somewhere. So the distance from those sources is a big part. But also, how much traffic you have at your gas station is vital to this. Because you've got to buy a lot of gas to put in that tank in the ground. At gas stations, you have, you know, I'm sure a lot of people know this, just kind of backfill. There's a large storage tank, actually multiple large storage tanks under the ground at all of the filling stations, all the gas stations. Obviously, you can't put diesel in the same container as the 87 octane. So you have to have different storage containers for each. And it's usually better to have a large storage container in there. That means you don't have to buy as often from the big supply. It means that when people show up, you don't have plastic bags over your gas nozzles because you've got enough gas to serve. So what happens if you bought the gas that you're selling at say, let's just give it a number, $4 a gallon. And now your competitor across the street who just got a new shipment at $3.50 a gallon, he can lower his price. He just bought a big shipment there. You're going to have to eat some of what would have been profit is now becoming maybe break even. And at times, if you actually just need to sell enough so that you can get new gas put in, you got to lower your price and take a loss. So that's part of the reason why at gas stations, the convenience charge for the candy or the drinks or whatever is quite high. If you go to a grocery store, sometimes just behind the gas station, the prices are half that for bottled water and sometimes much less than half of that for the things inside the store. So going from town to town, knowing that recently we've had an upheaval in the distribution side of gasoline and diesel. It's during the pandemic, everything was out of whack. Who did you get it from? How much was at the refinery? Nobody's buying gas, so I'm just going to lose my contract with the company that was providing it before. That's still kind of messed up. And people's travel patterns have changed. This is absolutely fascinating. Where they're going is different, and how they're getting there is different. So we saw dozens upon dozens of closed gas refilling stations on our trip. Was that common for you as well?
We did.
Closed, saw, just out of business, gone.
Well, but I also saw some places where we pulled in to get diesel where they didn't have any.
Right.
But the thing that struck me is, as you said, from one town to another, there was typically, it easily could be a 50% difference in the price. Now, I was getting diesel because I was driving a diesel-powered vehicle. A 50% per gallon difference in price, which was pretty amazing. But there was something else I saw that was very, very significant. We saw quite a number of traffic jams. Thank God they were all going the other way. They were all on the other side of the interstate.
God just said,
"You're welcome." We saw them on the way out,
by the way.
And when you see this, and I'm looking at it, about, well, let's put it like this. A majority of the feet, if you look the linear feet of a 5 mile long or 10 mile long traffic jam, a majority of the linear feet were tractor trailers, 18 wheelers.
Yeah.
And there were times when we were traveling through from the Appalachians, which is where we were, back to Texas, when the other side of the highway, what we could see coming, looked amazingly like there weren't any cars there. It was just solid, almost bumper to bumper, 18 wheelers going towards here. We were seeing very much the same thing. You know, we long ago said, what recession? Because we counted 18 wheelers on Interstate 35 and said, nope, that ain't a recession. It turned out not to be. And I think that's what we're seeing yet. The United States economy is booming. I mean, it is booming. And a lot of those were flatbeds with oversized loads on them, where things are being bought for construction or making of equipment.
Right. We saw construction of windmills, we saw new fracking. We saw, I mean, the amount of energy investment that we saw as we were driving, new solar fields being installed. It was really what we've been wanting to see, because our electric grid's not been that great. And to see the fracking and the solar fields and the wind farms all being built in the same areas, it's really hard that the same landowner is getting paid three times in a lot of these cases. It's pretty awesome. Very cool. And we're about out of time for this hour. We are going to be back next hour. There's more to talk about what's going on in the energy world, why we're having the disruptions that we're having at the gas station and so on. It's good stuff. We've lots to talk about on that subject. But we kind of have a hard break. So if you'd like to talk to us off the air, we actually do investment advice for real people and portfolio management. If you'd like to talk to us, we have voicemail on the weekends, real life people during the week. You can call us locally at
254-947-1111.
Or toll free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, where you can see our made for radio faces, sign up for our newsletter, read our newsletter. If you don't like signing up for things, you can download our radio programs going back a long ways, get our podcasts wherever you get podcasts. You can contact us through the contact form or email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com.